Hi, good morning, everyone. First, our share today, as usual, is sponsored by Mel David, in gratitude to Hashem for the many blessings he's been given, and we all wish Mel many, many brachos. Also, I just got word there was a terrible bus accident, and from Tel Aviv, he said? And the bus overturned for some reason, and there are a number of people that are seriously injured, so our tefillas should be for them, and also the learning that we do today should also be a zechus for everyone to have a refuah shleima. And Beis Hashem, maybe at the very end we'll say a kapitel of Tehillim, that everybody should be okay. Today, again, what I'm doing more or less for a while is trying to correlate different parts of Mishlei to the Inyanim of the Parsha, so that's why it skips around in terms of Prakim. And we know, of course, that we are now beginning the third part of Sefer Shmos. The Ramban divides the book of Shmos into three Chalokim. The first part is the story of Yetziat Mitzrayim. The second part, which is the shortest part, is the story of Matan Torah. And the third part is the building of a Mishkan, a tabernacle. And the Sifra Chassidus explains that this mirrors the journey in our own lives, that we first have to leave our own Mitzrayim, because remember the word Mitzrayim does not just mean Egypt, but it goes to Meitzarim, the boundaries, the constrictions, the blockages that prevent us from serving Hashem, whether it be our egotism, whether it be our selfishness, our hedonism, our laziness, our depression. These are our inner Mitzrayims from which Hashem gives us a geula if we seek it. But then, it's not enough to be liberated. You must use your liberation for the purpose of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which brings us to Matan Torah. I think I've mentioned before the Indian poet Tagore that analogizes a human soul to a violin string that is capable of producing beautiful music, but only when the string is tied down. If it's a totally loose string, you cannot get any sound out of it. So too, freedom without submission to the Ribono Shel Olam does not bring out the beauty of the soul. And the third level in our life journey is to make our heart and soul a dwelling place for our Kaddish Baruch Hu. Because even if you're keeping the Torah, one does not automatically open up one's heart to Hashem. And that is really the highest level. And indeed, in the Parsha dealing with building the Mishkan, we have the Pasuk, V'yasu li mikdash v'shachanti b'socham, builds for Hashem a sanctuary, so I will dwell in their midst. And Chazal's famous drasha is, the Shekhinah is not dwelling in the building, the Shekhinah must dwell in our heart and in our soul. And in that sense, people ask the question, if there's a mitzvah to build a Beis HaMikdash, why don't we actively pursue that mitzvah today? Now there is a group, there are groups in Israel, that do say that we should aggressively be involved in building the Beis HaMikdash. If that means bulldozing the Harabayit, so to speak, go ahead and do it. And yet, we do not find that the Gedolei Torah have advocated for aggressively building the Beis HaMikdash. And it's actually a question, because after all, V'yasu li mikdash is one of the 613 commandments in the Torah. V'yasu li mikdash. Why don't we get involved in building the Beis HaMikdash? So the technical halachic answer is based on the Rambam, who specifically says that it is Mashiach's function to build the Beis HaMikdash, and that is how you know somebody's Mashiach, when he succeeds in building the Beis HaMikdash. What is the source of the Rambam's assertion? That itself will need further investigation, but nevertheless, given the Rambam's psak, it's not that we build the Beis HaMikdash and then Mashiach comes. Rather, it is Mashiach's job to build the Beis HaMikdash. Rashi says something even more drastic, that the third Beis HaMikdash is not built by human hands at all. It comes down min hashamayim. So for those two reasons, we are not actively involved in physically building a Beit HaMikdash. Now, let me just point out, the Temple Mount people do have one halachic source that supports them, and that is a passage in the Talmud Yerushalmi that says, building the Beis HaMikdash will bring Mashiach. So they actually, based on this Yerushalmi, they look at it as an absolute obligation now to bring the Mashiach. Well, that is a source. I'm not going to deny it. But nevertheless, both Rashi and the Rambam seem to reject it as a source, and therefore the halacha will not be in accordance with that Yerushalmi. But one point to keep in mind is this. You know, we now know, those of you who are familiar with the internet, not that you should be, but just in case you accidentally came across it one time, know this concept of virtual reality. So the truth of the matter is, even though we don't build the Beis HaMikdash with physical bricks and mortar, that will await Mashiach and Min HaShamayim, but we do build virtual bricks in Shamayim, that every time we do Torah and Masim Tovim and Avas Yisrael and Chesed, we are adding a virtual brick to the celestial edifice of the Beis HaMikdash that is in heaven. So we are potentially, we are able to build the Beis HaMikdash every single day, or to contribute to its building every single day. And when there are enough virtual bricks to make the whole building, that's when it comes down. So if you ask the question, do we fulfill the mitzvah of building the Beis HaMikdash bizman hazeh? The answer is we do, but we do it primarily in a spiritual way, by making our heart and soul a merkava, a dwelling place for the divine. Indeed, the Gemara tells us that even before the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed on the 9th of Av, the Jewish people had banished God from their hearts and their souls, and therefore he was no longer living in the Beis HaMikdash. Nebuchadnezzar, when he destroyed the first temple, was very proud. He thought he had defeated Hashem in Hashem's own house. And Hashem actually told him, I don't live there anymore. It was an empty house. Anybody could destroy it. Kimcha techina tachanta. You have ground up flour that was already nitchan, that was already ground up. You did not accomplish anything. Right? So in these parshios in particular, we think about building a Beis HaMikdash of the heart. And in that case, when we make our heart and our soul a dwelling place for the divine, then God's presence will indeed become manifest in our hearts, in Klal Yisrael, and then there will actually be a Beis HaMikdash that will be symbolic of that. Now, one of the ways that we bring the Shekhinah into the world, and indeed this was in Parshas Truma itself, is by our willingness to be Oseik in Staka and Chesed. And if you go through Mishlei, you will see that tzedakah is actually one of the things that is most often mentioned in Mishlei. I went through Mishlei itself very, very quickly, just a quick review of the book, and I identified at least 25 psukim that deal with the importance of tzedakah and Chesed. I'll just read you a few of the psukim just so we will always have some psukim of Mishlei that we mention. First is the famous Pasuk, Perek Yud, Pasuk Beis, Tzedakah Tatzil Mimagas. The giving of tzedakah can save a person literally from death, and the Gemara has various stories. The Gemara gives a story about Rabbi Akiva's daughter, that she was getting married at the day of her chasna, and she stuck a pin in the wall just to keep the pin there. Then they discovered later that the pin went through the eye of a poisonous, venomous snake that was going to spring out and kill her. And miraculously, she put in the pin exactly at a point where it killed the snake. And Rabbi Akiva asked her, what was your merit? Why did Hashem give you this miracle? And she basically said that she had given tzedakah to somebody earlier that day. And Rabbi Akiva said, this is the meaning of the pasuk, tzedakah tatzil mimaves. that stuck us, that can save a person, God forbid, even from death. Other psukim, matan b'seser yichpe'af, that he who gives privately, meaning you do, remember the highest level of tzedaka is when you give it anonymously. Matan baseser yichbe'af. It overcomes, it conquers, it vanquishes the anger that God might have on us for other aveiros that we've done. So it's a tremendous thing. Tzedaka, chesed, and this is especially augmented when it involves the supporting of Torah. Eitz chayim hi l'machazikim ba. The Torah is a tree of life for those who support the Torah. Machazikim ba, hachzakas Torah. Indeed, let me point out, in the Parsha, there are a number of connections to this idea. You know, the very first utensil that is described in the building of the Mishkan is the Arun HaKodesh. And the next one that is described is the Shulchan. The Arun HaKodesh is the ark that was kept in the Kodesh HaKodashim, and in that ark were the Luchos, both the second Luchos that were whole, and even the first Luchos that were shattered. By the way, as an aside, it's not really our topic for today, the Gemara has a beautiful drasha that you must show honor and kavod to a Talmud Chacham, even if he has forgotten all of his learning. Because even the broken luchos are kept in the Aron HaKodesh because they were once the repository of the Torah. And in a more general sense, this is a very beautiful idea to think about the honor and the kavod that we give to older people, whether it's parents or relatives who unfortunately may be suffering a diminished capacity, but even the shivrei luchos are munochos bi'oron. But if you look at the dimensions of the Aron HaKodesh, you find that all the dimensions of the Aron are shivuchot, meaning they are fractions. 1.5 amos, 2.5 amos. In other words, all of them are fractions. Now, when you look at the next kli that's described, this is a gold shulchan that is in the Beis HaMikdash, or the Mishkan, later the Beis HaMikdash. And on this gold shulchan were placed every Shabbos Lechem HaPanim, 12 chalos. And they were baked on Friday, but they were placed on the shulchan on Shabbos. And they would not be eaten until next Shabbos, when they would be replaced by new lechem, and Kohanim would eat it. And there was a great miracle for the Lechem HaPanim, that although it was on the shulchan for an entire week, the bread was still warm and fresh. The Lechem HaPanim. So, in this connection, if you look at the dimensions of the shulchan, you will find some of the dimensions are fractions, and some of the dimensions are whole. So when it comes to the Aron, all of the midos, all of the dimensions are shivuchot, fractions. When it comes to the shulchan, some of them are shivuchot, and some of them are shleimot. So the Kli Yavor says a very beautiful idea. He says that the Aron HaKodesh represents Torah. When it comes to Torah, I should always regard my knowledge of Torah, my accomplishments of Torah, as incomplete. In other words, by definition, it's not a whole number. I never make it. There's always a process. There's always more to learn. There's always more to understand. A person can never have the attitude, I've learned enough. And therefore, the midot are shivuchot to indicate the sense that I'm always missing something. I have to keep on going. That is why a person that is learned in Torah is called a Talmid Chacham. Now, Talmid Chacham literally means a student of the wise, or maybe a wise student, because the definition of being wise is knowing you're still a student that has to learn, no matter how much. And that is Merumaz, the Kli Yavor says, in the midos of the Aron being Shavuot. Now, what is the Shulchan? The Shulchan, which has the Lechem HaPanim, that represents Parnasa, that represents sustenance, physical Parnasa. In fact, the Gemara even says, The Shulchan was in the north, and therefore if one of the Mikdash or the Mishkan, if one prays for Parnassah, you pray in the north, towards the north. Now, when it comes to Parnassah, you have to have an equivocal idea. On one hand, it should be a Zeyu Asher, who is wealthy. Hasameach b'chalko, you're happy with what you have. Now, in Ruchnius, that's not true. In Ruchnius, you have to always want to grow. So, Sameach b'chalko is primarily in Gashmius. In the material world, Baruch Hashem, I have enough. I have what I need. I'm happy with what HaKadosh Baruch Hu gives me. Now, sometimes you say, well, you know, wouldn't it hurt to have a little bit more? You know, we say that. On the other hand, the Chafetz Chaim once told somebody, how do you know? You know, you never know. The spiritual world is quite a complicated dynamic, and maybe extra money creates extra nisyonis. You know, there are whole books about the tragic lives of people who won multi-million dollar lotteries. You know, you think, oh, if only I won the lottery, my life would be. You know, the mamish books of people who they lost, you know, whatever, first of all, they lost it all, and they got divorced, and the families broke up, and the hatred, etc., and the hate, even threats to their lives, you know. Why can't you lend me $100,000? You know, you have, you know, 10 million, whatever it is. So the truth of the matter is, money does not buy happiness. That's an obvious point. And Sameach b'chalko means Baruch Hashem. But here's what the Kli Yoker says. So the reason why some of the midot are shleimot is the attitude that I should feel in my gashmius life, I have everything I need. Shalem, it's complete. So why are some of the dimensions fractionalized? Because that also means you shouldn't indulge to the furthest extent, meaning to say there's a certain amount in which you don't go, meaning in our materialistic lives, we hold back a little bit. We don't simply indulge to every extent we can indulge. Now, it is true that the Talmud Yerushalmi says that Hashem will hold you to account for every pleasure of the world, permissible pleasure, that is, that you could have enjoyed, that you didn't enjoy.
Where is it?
The Talmud Yerushalmi says it. Because after all, Hashem made a world of beauty, and Hashem made a world of so many nice things. If a person simply says, I'm not interested, he's spitting at Hashem's Bria, and God forbid he's spitting at a Kaddish Baruch. One should enjoy life with a sense of gratitude to Hashem, but it has to be in moderation. You don't go all the way. And that's why the Midah is Shlema in the sense, I'm Sameach b'chelko. Its shavura is, you know, I don't have to finish the cup all the way to the bottom. I can leave something behind. I remember there was an advertisement, I don't think they have it anymore, Pepsi Cola. This was in the States. If you drank enough Pepsi Cola, you could get all sorts of prizes. In fact, they even had, I remember this when I taught law school, they even had a case, and this was a totally joke commercial, where if you had like 10 million or 20 million Pepsi points, you could get a fighter jet. And they showed a high school kid, it was a cute commercial, where everybody's riding their bicycle to school, and he kind of, you know, has a whole jet, you know, the whole school gets blown away with this jet. So anyway, they picked a number that was, you know, absolutely impossible for anybody to get, but somehow, some kid in New York managed to get 10 million points. Maybe the Iranians helped him out a little bit, or whatever it was, and he demanded delivery of the jet. He said, I have met all of the conditions. Now, first of all, it's illegal. A private citizen cannot buy a military jet, you know, whatever it is. And they said, come on, kid, it's a joke. But he took them to federal court for breach of contract. They broke a contract. Pepsi did win. The court said to the kid, yeah, it's a joke. But it's interesting that Imamash took them to court, and the judge had to write an opinion, you know, explaining why they weren't bound. So I think Pepsi stopped offering the plan, just in case some other judge might rule differently in the future. But the Pepsi motto was, drink Pepsi, get stuff.
Get stuff.
Get stuff, which means there's a certain attachment to materialism that is so complete that it doesn't even make a difference what you're getting anymore. I just want more stuff. I want stuff. And whatever it is. And that's where it's not even utilitarian anymore. In other words, a person could want something because they can use it for something. But at some point, we become so magushan that I just want stuff. And therefore, the Kli Yakar says, the remez to a midah shavura in the Shulchan is that you don't have to go all the way. So on one hand, the shalem means sameach b'chelko emotionally. The shavura means you don't go all the way. And he says an interesting thing. The Gemara in Brachos tells us, it describes how a person davens. So it says, a person should daven with einav lamala. His eyes should be looking towards Hashem. No, I'm sorry. That's right. Libo lamala. His heart should be raised towards Hashem. V'einav, but his eyes should be lamata. You look down like in a submissive stance. So, I'll peep shot. This is perfectly understandable. Your heart is soaring to Hashem, but your eyes look down. But the Kli Yakar offers a drush. It's derech a drush, but it's very nice pshat. He says, the lev, the heart, refers to your understanding of Torah. We ask Hashem, even though anatomically that's not the way we describe it today, but certainly in Tanakh we describe the lev as the source of understanding. So when it comes to understanding of Torah, lamala, you're always looking at the people who are greater than you and say, wow, they're so great, I want to be like them. So when it comes to inyanim of the lev, you're looking at lamala, the people who are more than you. But when it comes to the einayim looks at the physical world and is attracted to wealth and riches. Lamata, look at the people who are less fortunate than you and be grateful with what you have. So when it comes to Torah, I look at the gedolim and I say, I want to be more like them. When it comes to the einayim that looks at the physical world, you look at all the people, right? The old saying, I think maybe an Islamic saying, actually an Arabic saying, I felt bad that I had no shoes until I saw somebody that had no feet. Yeah.
I was thinking also that maybe for yourself, you're supposed to feel that you have everything.
Yeah.
But when you look at other people, don't say, you know, be sameach b'chalkecha.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to say, I think that's very true. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter used to say that somebody else's gashmias is my ruchnias. Meaning to say, somebody has physical needs. So I could be a tzaddik and say, oh, physical needs, you have to have steak, you have to have this and that, you know, you should be a religious person, be a tzaddik. Well, that's a cheshbon you can make for yourself. When you look at somebody else, if that's what they need, that becomes your spiritual imperative. You know, I had a bit of a sad incident where one of our Abraham is getting divorced, unfortunately, after a very short marriage. And just Mesiach Levituma, just in terms of casual conversation, he mentioned to me a story, and I was quite taken aback. And then I understand a little bit why there was such a severe Shalom Bayis problem. And that is, he had mentioned at the engagement party that he did not give his wife, his Kala, a gift. And he told her, because since we're, you know, living a life of Torah, I thought it was not appropriate to begin our marriage with physical gifts. And then he was a little perplexed. She seemed very upset at that. You know, I'm not sure why. So I said to myself, okay, now I understand why there's a gap here. Meaning, to kind of say, I'm a tzaddik, I'm not involved in gashmias, therefore I don't give my wife a gift. You see the problem. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, somebody's gashmias, and certainly your wife's gashmias, your spouse's gashmias, is not just gashmias anymore. It's not just physical. It is part of my spiritual avaida to be sensitive to what makes another person happy and what gives them nachas. Okay? And that's why the Beis Halevi once told the rich guy, it was very interesting, the Beis Halevi once told the rich man, this rich man was a big, big tzaddik, and he slept on a bench, and he only ate bread and water. Beis Halevi said, you're supposed to live a fancy life, because if you eat bread and water, when poor people come to you and they're on bread and water, you'll tell them, what's the problem? I'm on bread and water too. So in order for you to feel what they need, you actually even have to live a higher standard of living, so you will appreciate what they need. Right? So this is how the Kli Yoker understands it, that when it comes to Torah, I should always feel I need more. When it comes to Gashmias, Samech B'chelko, but Kli Yoker says, you should not indulge to the fullest extent, or as you said, also a nice pshat, that when it comes to somebody else, you should feel that they're incomplete, I will give them very much what they need. In fact, the Gemara has stories. The Gemara has stories about somebody complained to Rava, this guy who collects tzedakah, I see him eating fancy meat and wine, so why is he collecting tzedakah? So Rava said, if that's what he needs, I didn't realize, I'm going to give him more tzedakah so he can get that. Okay. Now the Chafetz Chaim makes another point about this, which is relevant to our discussion of tzedakah and of tzedakah's Torah in particular. He makes the point that the Aron HaKodesh had rings in the side, and in the rings there were staffs or staves that were put in, and when the Aron would be transported by Bnei Kahas, by the Levim, right, they would have the poles on their shoulders and they would carry the Aron. So actually the Gemara actually says that the Aron miraculously carried them, but nevertheless physically it looked as if they were carrying the Aron. Now the Torah has a peculiar halacha. The halacha is that when the Aron is at rest in the Kodesh HaKodashim, you are not allowed to remove the staffs. The staffs of the Aron must remain with the Aron HaKodesh even when the Aron HaKodesh is in the Kodesh HaKodashim. Ad kidei kach, that the Gemara says, he who removes the staffs of the Aron when it's at rest has transgressed a lo sase, lo yosuru mimenu, and gets lashes. You can get 39 lashes, 39 malchus, for just removing the staffs of the Aron. Why is that so important? What's the big deal? So the Chafetz Chaim used to say that the Aron represents Torah and Torah learning. In the Aron are the luchos. In the Aron is also a Sefer Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote, like the official Sefer Torah, just like they have Lahavdil, in all weights and measures, there's an official measurement, and usually in a government office, there's the official gram, the official pound, right? Everything has the official weight against which everything has to be measured. So too, the Sefer Torah that Moshe wrote was the official Torah. In fact, the Gemara tells us that sometimes if there were some disagreements in Torah scrolls that somehow got there, they would actually go into the Kodesh HaKodashim, even not on Yom Kippur, to check it against the Moshe Rabbeinu Torah. In fact, it's brought down. People now, again, how often that happened, I don't really know. My impression was it was extremely rare. But theoretically, there actually was an opportunity to go into the Kodesh HaKodashim, not on Yom Kippur, in order to check a Sefer Torah against the Sefer Torah of Moshe Rabbeinu. But be it as it may, therefore, the Aron HaKodesh represents Torah. What do the staffs of the Aron represent? The supporters of Torah. They carry the Torah. They carry the Torah. They're the ones that enable the learning of Torah. Now, this is true not only financially, but also, as the Vilna Gaon points out, emotionally. One has to understand that we support Torah learning not only by the money that we give, but we support Torah learning by the attitudes of encouragement and emotional support that we convey to our husbands, to our children, to anybody. Because sometimes you can throw somebody money and indicate that they're really not worth anything. But Hachzakas Torah and Tzedakah in general is not only concerned with money, it is also concerned with dignity and respect, and emotionally building somebody up. So says the Chafetz Chaim the following. Those people who supported Torah, in the journey through this world, when that finally comes to rest in Olam Haba, the Machzike Torah will be together with the Lomde Torah. Meaning, because when the Aron is at rest, that's a remez to Olam Haba, which is the world of rest. And those who bore the burden in this world are going to share the reward in the world to come. And that's exactly the idea of Yisachar and Zevulun. Yisachar was the tribe that was devoted to the learning of Torah. And Zevulun was Osek in pragmatia, in commerce. And Zevulun has, right, that's what Moshe Rabbeinu said, Simach Zevulun bitzei secha v'yisachar bi'ohalecha. Rejoice, Zevulun, in your going out, and Yisachar in your tent. Concept is, Zevulun went out in commerce, Yisachar was in the tent of Torah, and both of them have the equal simcha because they share in their reward. Let me hasten to add that even Zevulans of the world do have a chiyuv to learn Torah every day. It's not like, you know, the person's patur lagamrei, but nevertheless, one has a primary emphasis and one is primarily in Olam Hazeh. So the Lo Yasuru Mimenu is a great remez and a great chizuk for those who are machzik Torah, that they will share. And of course, let me point out that in no case is this greater than that of a wife who helps a husband learn, that she is his shutaf in every sense, and maybe even has a greater percentage in the learning. And as Rabbi Akiva himself said to his 24,000 Talmidim, Shali v'shalachem shalah hi, all that I am and all that you are, he said to 24,000 Talmidim, is because of her. Of course, Rachel was unusual in that way, but this is how a husband should relate to his wife, and this, you know, creates true shalom bayis when there is respect and when there's gratitude and when there's appreciation and when there's a recognition that whatever a person accomplishes is only because of the ezer that they have in their family setting. Otherwise, it would be very, very difficult to accomplish anything. Okay. Now, there's another verse from the Chafetz Chaim, though, that's very, very interesting. The Chafetz Chaim was very involved in supporting yeshivas. He wrote constant letters for this, and of course all the yeshivas in Europe, this is before World War II, were financially very, very strapped. Everybody was living, I mean, all the Jews were living in poverty. There weren't that many rich Jews in Europe, and whatever, that's why there was a lot of fundraising in America and the like. But the Chafetz Chaim brings the Zohar. If you remember, the angel of Esav is fighting Yaakov Avinu. And the angel is wrestling with Esav. I'm sorry, wrestling with Yaakov. And at various times the angel wins and sometimes Yaakov wins. But in the morning Yaakov is victorious. But he is limping. So the Chafetz Chaim pointed out the following. Why is it so that only Yaakov has this confrontation with an angel, and we don't find an analogous confrontation with Avraham and Yitzchak? So the Chafetz Chaim says, we know that Pirkei Avos tells us, Al Shlosha Devarim Ha'olam Omeit, the world stands on three pillars, Torah Avoda, Torah Divine Service, and Gemilas Chesed, loving kindness. We know that each of the Avos exemplify one of those pillars. Avraham is the pillar of Chesed. Yitzchak, that is a Korban, was the pillar of divine service. And Yaakov is Torah, 14 years without sleep in the yeshiva of shame behavior. All three pillars are important. If a person only has Torah, he is defective. You have to have Chesed, you have to have Avodah. You need all three pillars. So in one sense, all three pillars are equal. All three pillars are equal. But in another sense, Torah is the first among equals. And the reason is, the Chafetz Chaim says, really based on the Gemara, that from the learning of Torah you will come to understand chesed and avodah. Because you learn the Torah, that's what the Torah says to do. But from chesed and avodah you will not come to Torah. And that is why, indeed, if you look at the history, again, I speak more of the United States, but I think you have the parallel in other countries as well. Look at the history of Torah Judaism in the United States. You do find that the first wave of large-scale immigration established essentially what you might call chesed institutions. Cemeteries, free loan societies, Jewish hospitals. And that generation was totally lost, at least the next generation. And then we have the golden age of synagogue building. I remember the beautiful, ornate synagogues, stained glass, beautiful, beautiful. Now, they are all churches, almost all of them are churches. Go to any inner city in the United States, and you will see in the black neighborhoods or other neighborhoods, beautiful, beautiful, beautiful old synagogues with the Aseres HaDibros still engraved in stone that Rachmana Litzlan are now churches. Again, halakhically, the truth of the matter is, it was pretty much usher, but people looked for loopholes and people did what they did and they sold it to intermediaries. Again, it's a halakhic mess. It should not have, what happened should not have happened. It is actually better to tear down a shul than to sell it to a church. On the other hand, the people needed the money. So I don't want to get into that. But the Chafetz Chaim predicted this. The Chafetz Chaim said, a Jewish society whose primary focus is chesed without Torah is not going to survive to the next generation. And avodah will not survive. To the extent there's been any type of growth of Yiddishkeit in the United States, it only started with the widespread establishment of day schools, Torah, Psora, really after World War II, more or less. I mean, there were yeshivas, kohelim. Because the good thing about Torah, the great thing about Torah, the Chafetz Chaim himself said, is it creates what you call intergenerational continuity. So therefore, the Chafetz Chaim says, the Yetzer Hara is perfectly willing to let Jews do good things in the short term as long as it's batuach, it's not going to last. So he's not going to fight Avram. Alright, do your chesed, Avram. That's fine. It's not going to last. Let you do it. It's like Ben-Gurion's attitude towards Haredim. Ben-Gurion, in 1948, exempted B'nai Yeshiva from the draft. There were only like 400 yeshiva students in Eretz Yisrael, and he figured they're going to die out, they're going to be extinct in 5 years, there won't be anybody, so what's the big difference, right? So here the same thing, except this is true. Let them do their chesed, they'll vanish. Yitzchak, let them have their shoals, they'll get rid of it. But Yaakov, his Torah, that's going to be nitzchi. The Sar Shel Esav has to stop that. So that's the Chafetz Chaim's for why the Sarah Shel Esav has to attack Yaakov. But then the Chafetz Chaim points out, so the angel of Esav, the Yetzer Hara represents, wanted to uproot Torah from Am Yisrael. And he did not succeed. He did not succeed. Because Jews will always learn Torah even if they have to live on bread and water. But he had a partial victory. Because the angel Yaakov was limping. His thigh was dislocated. So what the Zohar says is, the thigh supports the body. So even though the angel of Esav could not take away Torah from Am Yisrael, he weakened the support of Torah. So, the Chafetz Chaim said, there is a certain curse that Esav put on us, that the financial support of Torah will always be precarious and weak. Even when there are billions of dollars for everything, somehow chinuch and Torah are going to suffer. Even though there's enough money in the world, so to speak. Ad kedei kach, the Chafetz Chaim said, any mosad of Torah that does not have financial problems one must question its authenticity. Because if it's an authentic Makom Torah, it should be suffering. Now, be sure you understand that. That doesn't mean if somebody asks you to help a yeshiva or Makom Torah, you say, sorry, you're supposed to suffer. You know, that's reminiscent of the Christian response when anesthesia was developed for childbirth in the 19th century. So there were Christian theologians, all of whom were men, of course, who said, women are not allowed to take anesthetic because God cursed Eve, God cursed Chava. Be'etzev tel dibonim, you must suffer. That doesn't give you the right to alleviate your suffering. Now, halachically, without getting into the debate of natural childbirth, no, but halachically, that's not a valid argument. Because a curse is not a mitzvah. Meaning to say, when God said, when Hashem said to Chava, you will give birth with pain, that's not a commandment, you shall suffer. Hashem is saying, this is the nature of the world that I created, but you are allowed to do whatever you can to minimize that. Right? You're not mechuyev. Like everything else, there is sickness in the world, but we are not only allowed, but we are supposed to go to doctors and get appropriate medical treatment. In other words, a curse is just telling you what the nature of the world Hashem made is, but you still have an achrayas to try to make things better. So Hashem is telling you the support of Torah is going to be weak and going to be precarious, but instead of using that as an excuse, that creates more of an obligation to try to make it better. Right? This is the inyan of Hachzokas Torah. Now, let's let me go back to the parsha of Truma for a moment. When the Jewish people are told to donate for the building of a Mishkan of Hashem, and this is a very, very famous thought, the verb that is used is vayikhu li Truma, they shall take for me Truma. So people ask the Kasha, why take? They're being asked to give. It should say vayitnu li, they should give. So the Beis Halevi, as well as Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, they say the same thought, and that is, in Avodas Hashem, when we give to Hashem, when we give tzedakah, when we do chesed, when we support Torah, we should not feel we are giving. We should not feel we are suffering. We should not feel we are deprived. Lehepech. We should feel we are getting, we are taking more than we are giving. Indeed, we have a number of psukim in Mishlei that say the same thing. Let me just quote one pasuk. This is in Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Chavtalit, 11:24. Yesh mefazer v'nosaf od. The paradox of life is when I'm mefazer, when I scatter my resources, the nosaf, I am actually adding to myself. I am adding. I am not giving away. I am adding. And this is exactly, in fact, another pasuk in the same Perek Yud Aleph, pasuk Yud Zayin, a little earlier, gomel nafsho ish chesed. A person who is an ish chesed is gomel nafsho, is really giving to himself. The chesed you do for others is giving you something. And therefore, vayikhu li truma is a remez that those who give of themselves, and this can refer financially, emotionally, attitudinally, the idea is you're getting much more than you're giving.
What pasuk is that?
The one Gomel Nafsho, that's a Perek, that's 11:17. Gomel Nafsho Ish Chesed. And in fact, they tell an interesting story that a yeshiva bachur got engaged to a kala, and he brought his kala to meet Rav Shach, and the kala said she is so devoted to her husband's learning that she will give up everything. She will live on bread and water. She will sleep in the street. She only needs one dress, no clothing, no jewelry. She will do everything. She will sacrifice everything. So it sounds very good. When she stepped out of the room, Rav Shach told the person, I think you should break this engagement immediately. What's the pshat? This is a woman that said she would give up everything for Torah. Rav Shach said, if somebody's attitude is, I will have a miserable life if you say if you're learning Torah, but I will sacrifice. That can't last very long. That doesn't have staying power. You could be a martyr for a day or for 2 days. You're not going to be a martyr for 10 years, 20 years, whatever it is. He says, and eventually a person gets embittered and a person gets disgusted and things fall apart. Rather, Rav Shach said, the attitude has to be that this is a joy, and this is a privilege, and whatever deprivations there might be are simply lost in terms of the gain. Again, I can tell you, I mean, this is one of the Shalom Bayis issues we see in the Torah world, in which very idealistic young women are so prepared to sacrifice. But after a while, it's very hard to sacrifice. And Rav Shach says the attitude has to be one of joy on both parts. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to say, the attitude says Shver Tzayne Yid. It was hard to be a Jew. Destroyed a whole generation of kids growing up, in which their parents, who sacrificed much to be Jewish, this is the 1920s we're talking about, and indeed it was hard to be a Yid. But a kid grows up in that poverty, and a kid grows up seeing their parent have to get a new job if they didn't come to work on Saturday. They'd have to find a new job Monday morning. And they're in a free country, and they figure, why do I have to live that way anymore? We don't even realize it. You know, sometimes, you know, people look down at that generation that was not so learned and didn't have such a yeshiva education, and we know so much more halacha and so much more gemara. But you know, it's pretty easy to be a religious Jew today, at least on the level of superficially keeping mitzvahs. In those days, it was a real, real, real sacrifice. And if people have achieved greater levels today, it's along the lines of the midget on the shoulders of the giant can see further than the giant, to be sure. But only because they're standing on the shoulders of that giant. Okay, I mean, you have to realize, I still remember people from that generation. People who were really not learning at all, really. But they were devout. You know, they would go to Minyan 3 times a day, even in the snow. And they kept Shabbos. And they didn't know very much, because they were pre-yeshiva. And most of their people, even people from Orthodox families, left it. And the people that held on, tremendous mesiras nefesh. But nevertheless, if the attitude is it's shver tzayne yid, you lose people. So therefore the concept is only when you feel that you're getting from the mitzvahs and not just giving is there going to be staying power. They tell a similar story with the Elder of Nevardik. The Elder of Nevardik was a Talmud of Rabbi Saul Salanter. He was a bit of an extreme person. I have mentioned him a number of times before. For 2 years, he literally bricked himself into a home, meaning he couldn't leave a house. He had bricked up all of the house, and people would give him food through the holes. And because he was so indifferent to Gashmias, he wouldn't know what's milchik, what's fleishik. There were 2 different holes. One was a hole for milchik, one was a hole for fleishik food. And he was called Rav Yosef Horowitz, was his name, Rav Yisola Baal HaChorim, Rav Yisola of the holes. Now, many people in Nevardik thought he was absolutely nuts, and they went to the Aruch HaShulchan, who was one of the Gedolei Ador, the Rebbe of Nevardik. They said, we're going to tear down this house. This guy is crazy. And the Aruch HaShulchan, who did not agree with the Shita at all, but he still said, Rav Yisrael is a tzaddik. I don't agree with what he's doing, but let him alone. This is his thing. So for 2 years, This is shortly after he became a widower, shortly after his wife died. He literally was alone by himself, just learning, davening, meditating. 2 years, he was literally locked inside a house, locked, bricked inside a house, with only those two holes in the wall. At the end of the 2 years, he finished, whatever it is, he opened the house, and then he started, I guess he got a lot of energy in those 2 years, stored up energy. He started around 110 yeshivas throughout Europe. This was the middle of Stalinist Russia. He was a person who had, and his followers, they had unbelievable courage. Their shita of emunah was so extreme that they put themselves in sakanas nefashos mamish. Again, Chazon Ish felt this was not even halachically proper, but he was not afraid of anything. He would put himself in sakana. He had emunah. If he's doing the right thing, Hashem is going to protect him. Navardik, it's been diluted today a little bit, but Navardika emunah is the most extreme type of emunah. Again, the Chazon Ish actually felt it was beyond what halacha even permits, but this was Navardik. So because of this, Rabbi Yisrael, when he needed money for his yeshivas, he would ask anybody, even people who never gave, and he was often successful. So another Rosh Hashiva once asked him, Rabbi Yisrael, what's your secret? How do you get money out of these gevirim? I've been trying to crack them for years, and they don't give anything to me, or they give very little, and you're able to get a lot. So this is what Rabbi Yisrael said. Let me tell you the difference between you and me. You come to a rich guy's house, and you're in obvious awe of all that he has. You wipe your shoes very carefully not to track in mud. You don't sit down on his sofas because maybe you'll wrinkle them. You don't put your keys or your change on the table. Maybe you'll scratch the mahogany table. You convey to him that wealth is precious. Wealth is special. Wealth is great. And then you ask him to give it up. After you've conveyed to him how wonderful it is, you're asking him to give up something wonderful and precious. Of course he's not going to respond to you, because you're asking him to give up something. People don't like to give up something. With me, now again, this is not halacha lemaisa for fundraisers, with me, it's the opposite. I walk into his house, I don't wipe my feet, I track mud into the house. I sit down on the couch, I put my feet, my dirty shoes, on top of the table. I convey to the person, your stuff is absolutely worthless. Wealth means nothing. Havlei olam hazeh. But I have a proposition for you in which this wealth, which means nothing intrinsically, can be converted into something beautiful and enduring and significant. So Rabbi Yisrael says, I'm not asking you to give me anything. I'm giving you an opportunity to get something. So Rabbi Yisrael said, the reason I'm successful is I'm not asking people to give up anything. I'm offering them opportunities that will make their life better. People might be unwilling to give, but they're always willing to take. And this is Vayichli Dror. Now again, as I say, if any of you are our fundraisers, do not try this at home, so to speak. It may sometimes backfire. But I'll tell you the truth. When somebody really, truly believes it, it's not an act, that makes an impression. There is something about a person that is totally committed to the depths of their soul. In other words, for most of us, if we were even to try such a thing, there would be something theatrical about it. It would be like a shtick. But when somebody really believes it, that bowls you over a little bit. So I don't even know if this is a true story. I don't want to say it's a true story. Because there are chesh and mishpat problems. The truth of that is, you don't have a heter to simply muddy up somebody's rug. There are halachic questions about damaging somebody's property. So I don't want to say for sure that this story happened. And even if it happened, the Alter Rebbe may have been exaggerating the narration. I think he's really expressing the attitude he conveyed, not the actual things that he did. In fact, they tell a story about the Vilna Gaon, again, not connected, but it's also a story where Rav Chaim Kanevsky said could not be true. There was a person that had a shtreimel, and the shtreimel had, dirty fingerprints of cholent on it, that were there for 50 years. And people kept on saying, you know, why don't you clean the strimal? Why do you have these stains on your strimal over and over again? So the story that he said was, when he was a young chassan, he was in Vilna. And they brought him to the Vilna Gaon for a bracha. And the Vilna Gaon was in the middle of eating. And the Vilna Gaon's fingers were dirty, and the Vilna Gaon puts his hands on the strimal, and therefore he said, "These are the fingerprints of the Vilna Gaon. I am not going to get rid of them." Rav Chaim Kanevsky said, "It's not shayach that such a story happened." He says, "The story for sure is not true. Number one, Bichlal, the Vilna Gaon wouldn't have dirty hands. He wouldn't have eaten that way. Did he even have challenge? You know, who knows? And number two, just as a matter of dine mominus, the sehiris of the gra, he would not, even if his hands were dirty, he would not have touched somebody's clothing with dirty hands." And again, Chaim doesn't need my askama, but it's a dover pashut that, you know, even an average person would tend not to do that, and kal v'chomer, the guy in Hadar would not have done such a thing. So sometimes the stories have to be toned down a little bit. But the ultimate attitude still makes a lot of sense, that the altar in the Vardik said, my success is that I'm offering you something to get rather than asking you to give something to give up. And that's really the attitude we have to have towards Torah and mitzvahs. Gomel nafsho ish chesed. Okay, that's the Perek Yud Aleph, Pasuk Yud Zayin, that the chesed that I do brings a bracha to me. And therefore, all avodas Hashem, we get much more than we give. And in that way, a person can keep on giving because he or she understands how much they are getting from all of these things. Let me just end with the Nefesh HaChaim. You know, people learn the Nefesh HaChaim, and the Nefesh HaChaim, it's really the mission statement of the yeshiva world. Rav Chaim Volozhiner in Shar Dalet talks about Torah learning and what Torah learning accomplishes, etc. But that's only gate number four. In the Hakdama of Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Yitzchak of Volozhin, who was Rav Chaim Volozhiner's only son, I believe only son, says that the one thing his father told him every single day was not the importance of Torah study, interestingly enough. But he said, the purpose of our lives is to help other people in any way that we can. And if we're not able to help other people, then why did Hashem give us life? So it's very, very fascinating. I think people sometimes use the wrong emphasis of Nefesh HaChaim. If you ask anybody in the yeshivas, what is the main theme of Nefesh HaChaim? They will say Torah learning. In fact, the main theme of Nefesh HaChaim is the chesed we do for others. It happens to be, Rav Chaim Volozhiner holds, that the learning of Torah brings chesed into the world. That's true. But the ikur is the chesed that we do for others. And he said, and Rav Yitzchak Volozhiner says, that whenever he did not, he told his father a sorrow that somebody's undergoing, and he did not feel the pain of the other person, his father would rebuke him. He says, how can you not feel the suffering of another? How can you not want to help another? Lama lecha chayim. Why did Hashem give you life, if not to help others and bring them comfort, help financially, but also help emotionally, build people up rather than cut people down? And this is the ultimate purpose of our lives. And in doing that, we should feel that we are getting much more than we are giving. So you all have a good week. It'll probably be announced, but next Sunday I'm not going to be here. I don't know if there'll be a substitute or not. I have to make a short trip to Chutz La'aretz, Bezrat Hashem. I hope to be back, though, by the 2 weeks.